Agile Uprising Podcast.
Joining me today, we have Alistair Coburn, founder of the co-founder of the Crystal Family Methods, founder. Okay, I was going to give Jim Highsmith a little nod, but
Jim's thing was adaptive software development. He produced the book,
right?
Adaptive Software Development, in the late '90s, and he had a completely separate path of development than I did. Hmm. He was studying people at Nike, if I recall directly, and I was doing grounded research on project teams. It happened that we produced kind of recommendations that were startlingly similar for that time period. The most startling one was that both of us were committed to different methodologies for different situations. Hmm. So when we wrote the Agile Manifesto, most of the people in the room, I would say, were looking for the correct methodology, whether it be Scrum or XP or FDD or DSDM, with certain properties, the four values, and so on. And I remember Jim and we were so indistinguishable to the others, they actually made us like one person. So when they 10 minutes for every methodology, we got 5 minutes each because they couldn't tell us apart.
I can't see someone time boxing you to 5 minutes, sir.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, very good with time boxes. There's a great video of me doing a 5-minute lightning talk, and I finish after a long-winded question with 2 seconds to spare. It was awesome.
Nice. So we're going to get into the manifesto. I want to kind of just
yep.
What my plan here is to just step through the manifesto from what you were doing prior, the event itself, what's happened since, and then from here forward, looking forward, what are we looking for from the community, from your mind. So first and foremost, I greatly appreciate you taking the time
to carve
out here. I will try to be as respectful of your time as I can. We've done a few of these. We've met with a couple different people, some in person like I'm doing with you, others virtually via email, and some have just sent us straight to an article they've already written.
Okay.
But the intent is to circle with as many of the 17 of the original manifesto signers as we can and ask a similar bank of questions. So I found you today in London. We're sitting in beautiful downtown London. Took two Americans in London to sit down and have a conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
So first, I want to share with you one of the earlier meetings that we had. I was delivered something that I will assume you haven't seen.
I have not seen.
In quite a while.
I haven't seen at all.
You haven't seen it all? It appears.
It has handwriting on it. So
there is handwriting. So
this is John Kern's handwriting.
This is John Kern's handwriting. This is the original, I believe, the original agenda from Snowbird with John's handwritten notes.
That's my spreadsheet because I was the one who organized the thing.
When is the last time you saw this?
Then?
This copy. Well, not this exact copy, but the text, the typewritten.
Oh my gosh! I don't know. It's probably lost on my computer somewhere. I don't even know when I last see it.
So part of our
I don't have this.
Yeah. So part of our intent with this project is to take this artifact and turn it into something that we can share with the community. I mean, it goes through the names of everyone that was invited and eventually signed the manifesto. It also talks to some degree what the attendees were looking to get out of it before the event, so almost to set the context, I believe, so that you guys would have a more effective meeting in Snowbird.
So, do I have permission to comment on this thing already?
Sure.
Because the thing that I was about to say about Jim Highsmith and me is actually written on here.
Is it?
Which is that we were discussing the properties and the values, and each person was defending their favorite methodology, we looked at each other and said, we're both committed to many methodologies. What we want is that these things apply to every instance, every variation.
Beautiful.
And when I look at this, and that's what was our distinguishing characteristic in a sense, was that we wanted a different methodology for every situation.
Right.
And whatever we did should have these properties. And I look at this list here of the attendees and John Kern's notes and his like 2-4 word synopsis of what the people were. Then under Coburn, I wanted to see what he wrote. He just wrote multi-methods.
Ah. That's beautiful.
That's great. And under Highsmith, he put adaptive.
That's beautiful.
But multi-methods is what I was on about at the time.
So let's do a mental rollback. Let's start before the event.
Okay.
Pre-snowboard days. For anyone that's not familiar, what was your background at that time? What were you? What was your professional situation?
Yeah, so 1991, I was hired by the then fledgling IBM Consulting Group in Connecticut. And IBM had decided that they weren't just going to do services, but they were going to do real honest-to-goodness consulting. So they created an honest-to-goodness semi-separate entity called the IBM Consulting Group with its own logo and all the rest, and hired, you know, from the big consulting firms. And so we were not obliged to sell IBM products, which was very difficult for many IBM executives to swallow. We were independent of that. And my technical boss was Wayne Stevens, and Wayne Stevens had produced a methodology for information engineering category projects, which was a certain kind of database design and programming design and so on. And he was super, super, super knowledgeable, and very much of what I produce is very much, you know, along the lines of the direction that he established. And I don't know if it's causal or accidental or whatever. Mm. And I was hired in 91 to put a thread or a path in there for projects using object technology, particularly Smalltalk and C++. So I was hired to fit object-oriented technology into his methodology framework, which was also a multi-method in its own way. It was componentized and had reuse and incremental development and all that stuff in 1991. He's a very sophisticated, subtle thinker. It turned out with object-oriented, we couldn't fit it in. Actually, I had to make a complete parallel path. So my boss said to me, I said, I don't know anything about methodology. She says, why don't you interview and debrief project teams and find out what works and what doesn't work? We don't have prior vested interests, so whatever you come up with is fine. So that sent me down the path that I'm still on today of just asking people, what did you do? What did you like? What did you not like? What would you repeat? What would you not repeat? And I started out with Smalltalk and C++ projects. And the answers that I got within, you know, 1 or 2 years were so different than everything in the literature. It just sent me down this totally different path.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I read somewhere that even before the event, you had interviewed over 100 project teams.
I don't know. I wrote an article in 98, and I was able to list like 40 or something like that. So I mean, it's a good number.
Yeah.
And what I learned very quickly is you don't interview for failures, because there's more ways to fail than you can shake a stick at. Mm-hmm. There are relatively few ways to succeed. So I restricted my interviews to those teams that had successfully delivered a product. So I didn't say time and budget, just delivered. Mm-hmm. And from a methodology point of view, the people on the project would be happy to work the same way again, right, which excluded a lot of the potential interviewees.
Correct, yeah. So then you're in IBM. I imagine your phone rings or there was a wiki or something along the lines of a communication channel that the group is trying to come up, and I think you guys are looking at Chicago as the original location.
Well, you jump forward 10 years.
Oh, I'm sorry?
You jump from 1991 to 2001.
Oh. Okay.
Right. We have the whole of the 90s.
Feel free to catch me up. I apologize.
Yeah. So I started with these interviews and decided that I would rather omit stuff from the methodology and add it later, as opposed to put stuff in that I would later have to take out. So that was the path that, you know, Grady Booch had gone down, and I didn't want to repeat that. And so my first methodology in 1992 had only incremental development, use cases, CRC cards, and version control system was the only things that they had to have. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, we were already, you know, in the agile space, minimal methodologies. Mm-hmm. And as I continued, you know, the interviews through the end up being on projects in the 90s, I started to say, well, in this project we did this with 45 people, and in this project, you know, 6 people, this one 3, and stuff like that. And in 98, came up with this framework called Crystal, which was to say, okay, different projects need different things, and how would we characterize the situation which calls for a certain type of a behavior? And that got me into this. And I used Crystal as a way to separate them out, and I just use colors now. Right. The crystals are too complicated, so clear yellow, orange, red, and so on, as you add people.
Right.
So that was my sort of calling card, was at that time lightweight processes.
Yep.
And I used to give tutorials on designing a lightweight process. And the message was every project needs its own methodology, shrink wrapped to it exactly, and you have to probably change it every couple of months, every 3 months or something. You have to change what you're doing because the situation changes.
So, when you say the situation, do you mean that the people?
Yeah, the people. You add a person, you're a different, as it turns out, you're at the beginning of a project, it's different than when you're in midstream or when you're late in a project. You add more people, suddenly you've got more people, right? You add new technologies.
Right.
The way of working has to fundamentally change to track all of that.
Right.
And that was my calling card in the methodology space.
Cool.
So and so we used this stuff in 94, 95 on a project. And I met some of the other people who were at the writing of the manifesto in 1994. In Snowbird, there was a discussion group started by John Hopkins. Hmm. And the first year, who was there? Oh, it was just like the who's who of the people at the time. Adele Goldberg and Kenny Rubin and Ivar Jacobson.
Wow.
And Rumba and Martin Fowler and me and Kent Beck and Ward Cunningham.
Group.
And yeah, we had like 11 or 15 people, and we just had 2.5 days of just great conversation like that. So the meeting at Snowbird, in a sense, was modeled a little bit after John Hopkins's meetings in 94, 95, and 96.
Were there any artifacts, and obviously not a manifesto or values or principles, but was there anything that came out of those John Hopkins meetings?
Yeah, we just went for whatever notes we were doing. We didn't try to unify. You know, we had discussions about what's current and what's active and what's happening.
Hmm.
Traded notes, but we didn't produce like an output.
Hmm.
So the thing that was different in 2001, if you fast forward, we hadn't had any. 94, 95, we did some. I don't remember 96. And then I was in Norway in 98, and I held one actually on a boat, on a ship going through the fjords in Norway.
Wow.
In 98. And XP had just come out, so we had Jim Copeland and Kent Beck, Ward Cunningham, and Rebecca Wirsbrock was there, her husband. So it had been a couple of years. So actually in 2000, I was going like, we need another one of those things. So I was going to hold it actually in February of 2001.
Right.
And I was organizing my invitation list. And then Bob Martin sends out an email and says, hey, I think, you know, a bunch of us sound kind of alike. And I want to get together and write a manifesto.
Nice.
And how about February of 2001?
So it was Uncle Bob that gave you the notice?
So he gave us he had the mission. And I looked at his invitation list, and he had a better invitation list than I did and a better topic than I did. So, you know, I said, sure, you know, sign up for that. And then the trick was to, you know, to get it held in it's Snowbird and not in Chicago in February.
Right. So, the other was Antigua
or something, yeah. You know, yeah. So we were able to get it in Snowbird, I think because Jim Highsmith and I were both in Salt Lake. So that takes us up to 2001. So that's like the moment. And then Jim Highsmith was working for Qatar Consortium, and he got them to sponsor some part of it.
Right.
So we have to mention Qatar because they didn't have a representative, but they, you know, they were inside of that, thanks to Jim.
I don't know that I've ever heard that before. So that seems to have been trimmed on the history books. That's
yep.
good.
Yep.
I'll make sure I make note of that.
They, you know, they threw some money in the kitty. So
that's nice.
Jim Highsmith got them to help sponsor the meeting, so they should get some credit.
That's great. So the location itself of Snowbird, did that have any impact, you think, on the event? Would a different location have yielded anything?
Yeah, I think so. I can't remember if we went skiing or not.
I heard some went skiing.
Some went skiing.
Mornings were the meetings, and then the afternoons was free time. And
this is what we learned from the John Hopkins things, is we would, John Hopkins, who was a skier, would set it up. So we would talk from 9 till 12 or 12:30 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
have lunch, jump out on the slopes, do afternoon skiing from 1 to 4, and then get back and talk again from 5 to 7. So we actually had, you know, 5 solid hours of discussion, and of course we got to dinner and keep talking and stuff like that, but we had actually 5 solid hours of actual meaty discussion. And so we kind of cribbed off of, because some of the people in the room had been to that, you know, Kent and Ward and Martin Fowler had all been to that, so, you know, all had the image And I think that, that played into it. Right. If we'd been in some cold building, some cold conference room in Chicago, you know, the mood is different than when you're on the mountainside.
So all in all, you're happy with Snowbird being selected?
Yeah.
So if you can take yourself mentally back to that room, I think it was I'm drawing from a story I was told secondhand, but from what I understand, Martin was really the facilitator, at least for early on in the conversation.
We all took turns. The one of the things he was smart enough to recognize is that inside that group, you know, nobody can be the facilitator for long because they'll just get eaten up.
Right.
So basically, he started off at the beginning and said the same thing. You know, I think that there's something in common here, and if we all pull together, you know, rising tide raises all boats. I want to write a manifesto, and then pretty much he sat down. That was the end of it.
Do you recall an exercise where he had everyone write down one word on index cards and throw it into the center of the room?
Nope. It's interesting, whoever told you that, my memory is like this. So at the beginning of meetings with like 17 people who haven't met, this is what I call cat scratching.
Yes.
Period, where you're trying to figure out how to make progress. And so my memory is us all sitting in a circle. This is the way I tell the story. And we have to build an agenda, right? Everybody always has an idea how to build an agenda. So the problem is, how do you build an agenda when 17 people all have different ideas as to how to build an
agenda? And you guys are mostly type A's.
And so we're sitting in a circle and someone says, so how do we build an agenda? And one of the XP people pulls out the inevitable deck of index cards from their pocket.
Right.
In his pocket and goes, just write it on a card, and starts writing in a card and throws something in the center. It wouldn't be one word, it's whatever, you know. Mm. Write something on a card, throw it in the center. And all the other people in the room, there's like seven of them, they all have index cards in their back pocket too. So they'll all pull out their, you know, their index cards and start writing things and throw in the center. And somebody who's maybe, you know, not born in there goes, can I have an index card? Yeah, give them index cards. So we just start doing it. Then they're in the center of the room, and someone goes, so now we have all the stuff. How do we make an agenda out of that? And then, so you notice I keep saying somebody says. So,
right.
So we very, nobody knows who says what. It was like so well.
Right. I think that's the way that it's written.
Unified.
When you go back and look at it. And truth be told, I think we never said it. I think the part of the purpose of this mission was to try to figure out if somebody said something or some other thing happened.
I don't think any of us want to know who said what.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that nobody knows who. If anybody names a name that somebody does it, they've, you know, in a sense, broken the code.
Okay, so who took the
silence.
Picture? Who took the picture on that?
I have
that?
No idea. Don't ask me. I wouldn't have any idea.
Yeah.
But whoever had the camera knew who it was.
God bless them. They did. So.
Hang on. So the cards are all there, and then someone says, well, how do we make an agenda out of that? And someone says, well, I guess anybody wants to make an agenda, it makes an agenda, and anybody doesn't want to take a coffee break or something. So I took a coffee break, and they came back, and I don't care what the sequence was. And they're all pasted up on the window. Someone says, we have an agenda. And a little bit later, somebody goes, how do I add something to the agenda? And somebody else goes, just put it up there. And this person, I do recall, kind of, I don't remember who it was, kind of like looking around going, am I allowed to do this? Because nobody checked him, right? Nobody
right.
checked what he was doing. Went up and stuck something in the agenda. So we had no idea. It was just something else got stuck in the agenda.
There was no change control board for agenda items?
No.
Perfect.
So, but you see in that manner the nature of the discussion right from the very beginning.
That's beautiful.
Right, yeah.
The conversation then was driven mostly by the cards. Were you guys just pulling them and talking about it?
Yeah, we had the agenda, you know, and the first thing was, I can't remember if it was before or after, but one was everybody needs to describe their methodology for the people who don't know.
Right.
So Ari von Bennekom had to describe DSDM, which most of us didn't know, you know, and then Kent had to describe XP to Ari, who had never heard of it.
Right.
And, you know, the Scrum guys got up and so on. So that was one thing, you know, but after we said, okay, so... Yeah, it looks like there's enough similarity. We could maybe do something here.
Right.
You know? Well, I guess we need a word. Well, it's a name. Is there lightweight processes is an against category term.
Okay.
It's I'm against something.
Right.
What would we be for if we were for something?
Gotcha.
And then we started this. I happened to facilitate that section, so you know I remember a lot about that one. We spent about an hour on a name search, on a word search.
Right.
Filling up flip charts with lots and lots of words.
Now, there was some debate over even using the word light, correct?
We had debate over everything, yeah.
It's incredible that how much conversation must have been happening for how tight the values are that you guys came out with, yeah, with the manifesto itself.
Yeah, we wordsmithed those things till there was 100% unanimity on every word on there. There was no light consensus. That's pretty good.
So you didn't check me for jumping ahead again.
Do whatever you like.
No, it's fine. So what's interesting?
I don't know where you're going. You've got notes. I'm
it's fine.
I didn't want to let you jump 10 years, but if
what's
you want
incredible
to jump
is
half an hour,
you're actually answering the questions before I ask them, so it's hard for me to actually keep up. I'm not a professional interview if you had not yet picked up on that. But what is incredible is you talk about lightweight process, yeah, right, and lightweight methodology.
Well, that was the buzzword. That was the term that many of us were talking about in the late 90s.
Hmm. Yeah, so that's laid in the notes that I got from John, right? So it has LWP, LWM, and it's just incredible because me looking at it now, those letters have pretty much gone away. What we now talk about is agile methods or agile process, right? So I'm looking at it, and I'm trying to reverse engineer what the hell LWP means for the first time.
Lightweight process and lightweight methodology.
If you had my original copy, you'd actually see my scribbling on top of John's scribbling, where I'm like, oh, that's what this means. And you know, my hand's trembling as I'm writing all this going through it.
So we were going, well, lightweight processes, it may be true, but it's a crummy marketing term. It's got no hook on it.
Mm.
So how would we create something that had a proper hook?
And all right, so I'm not gonna go with names, but I did hear somebody came forward with the term agile.
You can't say anything about that. That's nonsensical because we did a brainstorm.
Hmm.
We had two or three flip chart sheets full of names. So if someone gets the claim, I put the name agile up there, it has no meaning.
Well, I don't think the person that I'm thinking in my head actually is coming forth and saying it. But
it's very important. People want to know, how did the name agile come around? It better be one of your questions.
Sure is.
Good. So tell me when you want to hear about it, and I'll get there.
I feel this is a good time.
Good deal. So I said, well, you know, I'll facilitate that. So, you know, it's like, okay, brainstorming time, everybody name every possible.
And by facilitate, you're standing at a flip chart in the front of the circle.
Writing as fast as I can, they're calling out the names. You know, columns of names. Like
so when you're standing at a flip chart and you're filling them out, you're going with a relatively small typeface there with your handwriting, or
there's a flip chart right there. You can see my handwriting. It's normal size handwriting.
But you're getting a bunch of names per sheet.
Oh yeah. I mean, how many would you get? 20 or something, 25 per sheet, two or three sheets. You got 50 names up there, right?
Yeah.
So when someone says, if you ever hear anyone says something like, well, so and so suggested name agile, well, yeah, every name possible was already given.
Right.
So then we've got all these names, however many it'd be, 50 or 70 possible, you know, catchphrases. And so it was, well, how do we choose between them? And, you know, normally you do a dot vote or something, but you want to do a little analysis. So somebody, of course, unnamed, but did suggest, and this is from Jerry Weinberg, says, Jerry Weinberg says that a way to do this is, and it's the most strange, backwards, phenomenal thing, name why you don't want one of these words.
Ah, reductive reasoning.
I don't know what that is, but that's what we did. And so we picked a word and said, okay, so we're not voting, we're not vetoing this word. We're just looking at the word. Why would you not want that word? And we'll call out, you know, why people call it why they didn't want that word. And we went through some number of words and some more flip charts with to understand what we were fighting, what we didn't want to have to say. And the dominant one I remember that came up over and over again that became the catchphrase, I don't want to have to wear pink tights and a tutu to say this word.
Oh, what word was it?
Not any of them. There were lots of them.
Oh, damn it. That would have made for a great little story.
No, but there were lots of them that we came up with that were very pink tights and tutu kinds of words. And we have, you know, 17 men in there. You could criticize, I don't know, women in there. There were 17 men in there, and we did not want.
Do you have an example or two of
No, I don't. Would have to send you if I think. Maybe someone does. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't think we took pictures of the flip charts or anything like that.
I may pester you.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, so we got through the what. So, okay, so now we know what we don't want to be stuck with, you know, put those all on the side. Now we can go, now look at those words and see which ones have, you know, managed to dodge the negative characteristics. Then we did dot voting. We got it down to like 5. Then we did more dot voting, thinking to get the winner. And we got a tie between adaptive and agile.
Hmm.
So now we had a tie, so we had to have a discussion, which was going to be the winner between adaptive and agile, some discussion. I can't recall the details, and a final vote in agile popped up. It was interesting because, to me, you have to have both agile and adaptive.
Right.
And for me, that was important in 2001, 2003 timeframe till the topic went away. Because agile, for me, is tracking rapidly changing requirements. Adaptive is tracking changes in culture.
Right.
So the adaptive is the changes in the methodology, which is my stuff.
Right.
Right. And agile is, you know, like XP is very agile, but XP is kind of like XP version 1 was a fixed thing.
Right.
As was DSDM and so on. But anyway, so agile came out at the top. So when somebody says, you know, I suggest that we went through so much stuff, right? It was examined and washed and scrubbed and held up by 17 people. And after discourse and multiple three rounds of voting.
That's such an interesting process that you guys went through.
Yeah. So it's not, you know, it's not a deep exit. I mean, it's not like just we fell under the word.
Right. Somehow. So then you talked about multiple methodologies that were being discussed. And obviously some folks were there to champion for their methodology, to stump for it and to talk about it and to see how it interplayed.
No. Nobody was there championing their methodology.
Well, you said folks were standing up and explaining them.
Yeah, at the beginning, it's a mind meld, right? So there's this right. guy from Europe who's doing this thing called DSDM.
Right.
Nobody knows what DSDM is. So he has to explain what is... He wasn't championing, he was just describing what is DSDM for us Americans who didn't know what DSDM was. And he hadn't heard of XP. So you have to do this basic description, like who are you, what do you stand for? But that wasn't a championing thing.
As you were sitting there and you were hearing the different methodologies, some of which I'm sure you had some familiarity with, others you had, like DSDM, you had none. What was your feeling as you heard these people describing things that were generally connected, correct?
To me, you know, I'd been a methodologist for 10 years.
Right.
So I was just hearing people say they like to work this way or that way.
Did you get a sense of excitement over the fact
No.
So the... So the output was the value statement, the four values, and then the principles.
Yep.
I'm sure it's going to be in the theme of what we've talked about so far, but do you remember if there are any that you brought forth and were really pressing for?
No, it was interesting. The values, you know, somebody, and fortunately nobody claims, you know, I'm the one who put the this over that thing.
Right.
Probably the person who didn't know who it was. But there's so much scrubbing of ideas that if someone popped an idea and it got accepted, it had already been scrubbed, right, and revised. But once we got the this over that, I think everybody recognized this was a stellar form.
Right.
And then we just worked it for, you know, an hour or more. We got all done. We sat around the whiteboard and literally said, does anybody have any problem with this? And someone would say, yeah, I got a problem with that part. So the part I had was they had working software over documentation.
Okay.
And I said, I have a problem with it. I can't say that. Documentation is too important. I can't just say you're going to dump all the documentation. So that's where the word comprehensive. So, well, you know, what do we do about that? So everybody was really helping each other. So what do we do about that? You know, and comprehensive documentation was, you know, the best we could do out of that one. But we wordsmithed that thing until at the end it was absolutely unanimity that there were no words anybody needed changed.
That's beautiful.
That was on the values. Now, the principles, we started to differ, and I remember that this is an interesting thing. In XP, they did three-week iterations.
Right.
That didn't mean they delivered every iteration. So people confused the word iteration with the word delivery. I needed a delivery every 3 months.
Right.
So we were at odds because they were looking for a three-week cycle, and I was going, but they were focusing on the word iteration, and I was focusing on the word delivery. So that's why the principle says every few weeks to every few months with a preference for the former.
Right.
So you see how we're like, here's your interest, here's my interest, how do we find words that give us that space, but the sense, the idea.
It's incredible you came to the degree of compromise that you guys did in that short window of time with 17 strong-willed people.
Yep. There were, I use the word generous listening. There was really generous listening in that room.
That's great. Should be more of that.
Yeah, I know. We are going to run out of time.
I know.
Just one second.
Yeah, so I'm going to jump ahead,
ahead.
Into... I'm going to
turn
ask
the tail. Pick the most important
question. Well, I'm going to ask the question that... There's two. I'm going to hopefully shoehorn in two questions. For the next generation of Agilists, the folks that are either starting to go down the Agile journey or people that are starting to really hit the ha and the re of the learning curve,
Yeah.
What do you hope for from them? What do you want to see them do, given the current state of Agile, the path that it's gone from the site until now?
I don't operate in that mindset. I hang out with people of all ages, you know, 20s to 60s. And when I'm with people in the 20s, I just hang on for dear life, right? They're doing stuff that's foreign to me. Hmm. Their thinking is foreign to me. I have no intention of putting my presuppositions, what they should be doing, on them. I'm more like watching them and seeing what's active in their way of thinking. They're much quicker here, and of course they've forgotten, you know, all of that stuff over there. So I don't think in that mode.
Right.
I'm more like watching what's active for them.
And final question, I see that we have people coming back in now, but what is your general sense? I can't imagine you guys saw the Agile Manifesto turning into what it is today, but
no.
What is your feeling of it? Like, when you look back at it, not just your place, but the place of the manifesto
and
software.
I think it's really cool. There was only one other time in our history when people did something like that, and that was in 1968, the NATO Conference on Software Engineering, where people came together to deliberately discuss what this is. And this is really the only second time that people really, like, what is this thing that we're doing? And what does it mean, and how does it work? So for me, it's very formative in that sense.
All right, what's your next question?
So I wanted to ask, when you go out and you do a great deal of public speaking, you do private trainings, and you talk to a lot of both seasoned Agile professionals and relatively junior folks that are looking to get into the industry. My question is, when you talk to people that are just emerging into Agile, or when you talk, if you were to talk to a niece or nephew that are trying to get into this industry, what hopes and wishes do you have for them? What do you want to see them do to make Agile fulfill the vision that you had back in 2001 when you guys got together and came up with this mindset?
Oh, that's a big question, all right. And it's interesting because it's a different answer if it's just like somebody at a conference or, let's say, somebody in a class, as opposed to if it's a niece or nephew. It's kind of funny that they come up with different answers. But let me just see, you know. How would they want to behave so they do the industry some good kind of stuff, right?
Exactly.
Wow, that's a good question. All right, so let's say someone's in my one of my classes or a workshop at a conference, and they ask me that big mouthful of a question. I guess I would say that you do two things. That you hone your technical expertise so that you can contribute and do a good quality job as you're contributing, and that'll make you a valued member of the group. And oh, by the way, it's also good for your career. And then these days, what I would say today is, given that you're asking this particular morning, that you hone your listening skills. I think that people don't talk about listening skills enough. Even I. I've got the heart of Agile, which is a great thing for, you know, for beginners who say, how should I get started? What should I do? I would go to the heart of Agile, collaborate, deliver, reflect, improve. But even when I talk about collaboration, I don't talk about listening skills enough. Definitely the second part first is technical skills. The second is becoming a good member of the team. So learning how to be a good member of the team. Will improve the industry, will improve the person's career, will improve the output of the project. So those are the two things that I would point people to. I wouldn't get so far, you know, at this level of the conversation with someone who's new to say reflect and improve, although obviously that's core to everything that I've done for the last 15 years. But as a starting thing, that's actually pretty complicated. If people would hone their technical skills and learn to be a good member of a team, and in particular, pay attention to listening, that will do lots and lots and lots of good things for them, their team, and the community.
So interestingly enough, there's a lot of, I think there's a good deal of documentation about how do you hone those technical skills. A little bit more abstract is, how would you guide someone to be a better team member and to specifically work on those listening skills? What practices exist?
Well, Funny that you should ask. About 10 years ago, I wrote an article on what improves collaboration. I had boiled it down and made a set of a deck of 15 or 16, 17 cards that have very specific shoe level actions and that people can take to improve what I would call the inclination to collaborate amongst their group that they're operating in. And I keep trying to, I think I've got a website up. I keep trying to set up some kind of a thing so people can order the cards, and maybe there'll be some requests after this podcast and I'll finally set it up. Mm-hmm. But this is basic starter kit on how to do collaboration in a group, in a meeting. So you'll see that. So that's actually it. There aren't a lot. I look around what improves trust, what improves collaboration. And most of the stuff is either very, very woolly or very long-term. And what we want that I was able to do with this particular article, if you look at my website, it's called Collaboration, the Dance of Contribution. Hmm. Has got minute by minute, second by second actions that people can take. So that's in the collaboration part. For the listening, no, it's something I've noticed and I actually haven't studied up on. So I don't know how to improve listening except just listen.
Nice. Well, I hope it makes you happy to know that the deck of cards that you gave me at the first Heart of Agile in Philadelphia still travels with me in my backpack as I go from city to city, from office to office. So
that's very good. Yeah, I now use that as a stock standard part of my advanced Agile training, and I'm moving it into my intro Agile training.
That's great. So you mentioned Heart of Agile. I think I'd be remiss to not give you an opportunity to talk about the upcoming event, the Heart of Agile Pittsburgh, right?
Heart of Agile Pittsburgh. Well, by the time, you know, people will listen to this podcast in 6 months from now, that'll be a done deal.
Yeah.
It'll be over, but they could look for another conference. The Heart of Agile, what happened was I was actually asked to design a two-day conference for a group of people who had been doing an agile conference for some number of years. And I had just started, come up with the Heart of Agile concept with the four words. And so I literally designed from scratch. I said, how would you organize a conference where the four themes are collaborating, delivering, reflecting, and improving? What would the structure of a conference look like? And part of the answer is it has to be very, very conversation oriented. So there would be, at any one time, there would be thematically, no matter the format of the group, of the moment, we would have like a morning session and all papers, tutorials, workshops, the open space discussions would have to be around the topic of collaboration. Mm-hmm. Anything you want, but it has to be around collaboration. And then an afternoon session, 1.5 hours, and the only topic that's allowed to be discussed is delivery. You can have tutorials on continuous delivery. You can have slicing tutorials. You can have open space. You can have experience report. You can have anything, but the only topic allowed is delivery for this point in time. And then another one on reflecting. There are people who've got techniques for reflecting, improving, and so on. So I designed this two-day conference that would be very community-oriented. And I have to give a keynote to kick it off because nobody knows what is Heart of Agile. So you spend about 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes on what is Heart of Agile. But for the rest of the keynote, I get off the stage. I start discussion. So the purpose of the keynote isn't to keynote, except for just to warm people up, but to warm up conversations. And then for the rest of that period, that hour and a quarter period, do some variation of a World Cafe or something, and ask people at their tables or in small groups to discuss when they've collaborated, when they've delivered, you know, what it felt like to do reflecting or improving. And the whole point of that plenary or everybody together session is to warm up conversation. So when people go to the first coffee break, they've already had a conversation about something that interests them. Hmm. And that sets the tone for the entire conference. So that's the design of the conference, that particular one I made, very deliberate and very specific. And then James Gifford picked up the idea with great enthusiasm and 1 year ago had the first ever conference actually run with this format, the Heart of Agile Conference. And end of April this year, 2017, it's in Pittsburgh. And there are people looking to organize similar ones in Paris and Australia. So the idea of having this kind of a conference, and the idea is you can talk anything you want, lots about Agile, but it's bucketed into like, are we improving collaboration? Are we improving delivery? Are we improving our ability to reflect? And are we honing our ways of improving? That's the heart of Agile Conference.
So I hope, I don't know if you know this actually, and I'm kind of surprised I haven't mentioned to you this to you before. Did you know that the Heart of Agile Philly is actually the genesis of the Agile Uprising?
I didn't know that. I don't think it would surprise me hugely. What's the background of that?
So you, first of all, you mentioned, as you were describing the Heart of Agile, the intent to build community. It just so happened I sat at a table with James Gifford and several other of the folks that started off the initial Slack group that kind of got this whole movement, this whole community, and this whole group moving. And ever since the end of the second day, we just started talking to each other and found out there was a lot of synergy in what we were seeing and what we believed and what we wanted to get out of the Agile community. And if it wasn't for the Heart of Agile, I don't know that this whole project would have ever started. And I don't know that we would have gotten a lot of the artifacts that we've managed to get from your signatory cohorts available to the public domain again. So
that's really cool. Yeah. So if this set of interviews came out of that, that was, as far as I'm concerned, that justifies everything about the existence of that conference. Because what you've done with the interviews has much longer lasting value with those interviews than just the conference by itself. So I'm really, really happy to hear that. Thanks.
Yeah, no worries. And I
so let's see what happens in Philadelphia. But there was a question that you said you would ask. It was kind of just outside the question you asked, which is something about people getting started. Right. With Agile. And, right. And like, how are they going to change the world? But just how do they get started? How do they orient themselves as they're getting started? And this is where the Heart of Agile comes in. It's really, I created it as a starting point because Agile just has gotten so cluttered up since 2001. And it's natural. I don't get upset that it got cluttered. Some people get upset. But it's a natural outgrowth when you've got 500,000 people really trying to learn this thing. They all ask questions. How do we do this? How do we do that? How do we do this? And when an authority answers the question, it goes into a codification of the practice. And we very carefully wrote that manifesto to avoid codification of practices. It was very deliberate because we wanted to allow the 17 of us to disagree, to operate differently, but to find the common place that we were building out of. And what you build out of is values and practices. So the Agile Manifesto is very deliberately underspecified. So naturally, when people come in to the industry, they ask for like more guidance. And shu-ha-ri, right? So we really wrote it at the re level, and people coming in needed it at the shu level. Well, that's all very well and good, but then they take it as doctrine, they take it as gospel, they take it as rules, you know, that they have to follow. And what I'm trying to do is to find something that has commands, that's imperative, that's you can follow as a beginner, but doesn't give you the rules. Is there any way to do that? Like, that's been a riddle, right? How would you get someone started with Agile without giving them rules? And so what I was attempting to do, and I think I'm doing pretty well with the Heart of Agile, just the four words, is literally everybody knows how to collaborate. They know if they're doing it, they know if they're not doing it, they darn well know how to do it better. So you just say collaborate, and then they'll invent their own techniques. And so they don't get hung up on the, but should I do it this? I don't care. Are you collaborating? Is it working? Done, right? Go read books, invent stuff, whatever crosses your mind, whatever. Delivery is more technical because you get into, you know, slicing, user stories, continuous delivery, all that kind of stuff. It's more right. technical. You still know if you're doing it or not. You may not know how to do it better, but you know if it's, you know, if it's taking you 3 weeks to deliver, you can make it 2.5 weeks, 2 weeks, right? Da-da-da-da-da. So deliver better. You know, and reflect is a tricky one because people are not used to reflecting and thinking about whether it's analytics or their emotions or whatever. But, you know, get a group of people and say, let's reflect about this for a moment. and improve everybody who knows what they're doing. So the idea here is that is to give something for beginners that doesn't give them rules, but is actually directly actionable. And the pleasing surprise has been that people who've been in the industry for a long time breathe a sigh of relief because they recognize those four actions as critical actions, and they can get away from the rules that are beginning to bind them, given to them by beginners. And they go, yeah, 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 just do that. Like, let me do that, and you do that, and we'll all be cool. You can follow the rules if you want or not, right?
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, I completely agree. And I was recently talking with Jason Little. He's the author of Lean Change Management, and he was talking about the counter movement. So every time there's a giant movement, which Agile has become, there's always that counter movement that kind of tries to refocus and tries to, you know, get back to the core of what the initial point of that larger movement started from. And I think Heart of Agile is doing exactly that. It's trying to rebase us on what is important. Not all of this, this ancillary stuff, all these regulations, all these huge, heavy frameworks and processes that have kind of come out under the banner of Agile. But what is it that we were trying to do? And I think Heart of Agile very much focuses you back on those four discrete elements.
Right.
So, Alistair, if anyone's looking to catch up with you or hear more about the forthcoming Heart of Agile conferences, where can they find you?
I'm on Twitter. Is a really good place to go. Just send me a little message. I do all my technical discussions on email, and it's really funny to me when people hide their emails from the web. I don't. I just publish it. It's talistair@aol.com. And the website is alistair.coburn, spelled with a CK, alistair.coburn.us. And I've got most of my material up there, pretty much, you know, all my presentations, articles, you know, chunks of my books, poems, photos, you know, all kind of stuff there.
And for rounding it off, the Twitter is T Other Alistair.
T Other Alistair also. Yeah. Yep. By the way, the T Other, in case it seems very weird, when I go places, I always try to sign up as Alistair, and there's always someone who's beat me to it. Mm. So I decided that my name was going to be The Other Alistair. And then when I tried to put that on Twitter, they truncated it at 15 characters, and for a while I was The Other Alistair. And nobody could find me. That was really a loser. So I went to, rural dialect. I think it's Southern dialect, where they say t'other. You know, the other, they say t'other. So some of my places, I think maybe even on Twitter, you'll find the apostrophe, T Other Alistair. And so the way you pronounce it is t'other Alistair. And so I'm luckily so far, I'm always the first t'other Alistair anywhere. I haven't found another t'other Alistair has beaten me, because I'd hate to be the other t'other Alistair.
I think a lot of people appreciate that explanation, because the way I say it in my head is not what you just said. So
it's really funny to see people try to read it. They go to their Alistair.
Okay.
Like, what's that doing in there? To their Alistair. No, it's t'other, because I'm t'other Alistair.
Nice.
There you go.
Well, I appreciate.
Well, and the last thing is, I'm just trying to figure out how to set up a school. And so I'm going to teachable.com. Just yesterday I set up, you know how a walking skeleton works. So I set up one school. You can set up multiple. I set up one school, and in it I put one course, and in it I put one lecture, and in it I put one video, one photo, one text, and it has one quiz, and it costs $1. So hopefully I'm going to, my goal is to take the stuff not off of my website, but move some part of it over and have on Teachable or someplace, specifically a school for use cases where we can get into, you know, I've got hundreds of frequently asked questions that people have asked, where I can put up questions about that, or Crystal, or Agile in general, or Heart of Agile, or Carpaccio, whatever. So I look forward to that. People can maybe just track that and see when I finally get my little ass in gear and get that going.
I'll make you get in gear. I'll put it in the show notes so then people can start prodding you to keep moving.
Yeah, very good.
Cool.
Well, I appreciate you giving us the time again, Alistair. I mean, the supplemental content is as gold as the original content, so thank you.